It would take some doing.
Yes, said Miss Marple, it would take some doing, but then I think, Mr. Raphael, you would enjoy that.
Mr. Raphael stared at her for quite a long time, and then he suddenly laughed.
You've got a nerve, he said. Not quite the gentle, fluffy old lady you look, are you? So, you really think I'm a murderer?
No, said Miss Marple, I do not.
And why?
Well, really, I think just because you have got brains. Having brains, you can get most things you want without having recourse to murder. Murder is stupid.
And anyway, who the devil should I want to murder?
That would be a very interesting question, said Miss Marple. I have not yet had the pleasure of sufficient conversation with you to evolve a theory as to that.
Mr. Raphael's smile broadened.
Conversations with you might be dangerous, he said.
Conversations are always dangerous if you have something to hide, said Miss Marple.
You may be right. Let's get on to Jackson. What do you think of Jackson?
It is difficult for me to say. I have not had the opportunity, really, of any conversation with him.
So you've no views on the subject?
He reminds me a little, said Miss Marple reflectively, of a young man in the town clerk's office near where I live, Jonas Parry.
And?
Mr. Raphael asked and paused.
He was not, said Miss Marple, very satisfactory.
Jackson's not wholly satisfactory either. He suits me all right. He's first class at his job, and he doesn't mind being sworn at. He knows he's damn well paid, and so he puts up with things. I wouldn't employ him in a position of trust, but I don't have to trust him. Maybe his past is blameless, maybe it isn't. His references were all right, but I discern, shall I say, a note of reserve. Fortunately, I'm not a man who has any guilty secrets, so I'm not a subject for blackmail.
No secrets, said Miss Marple thoughtfully. Surely, Mr. Raphael, you have business secrets.
Not where Jackson can get at them. No, Jackson is a smooth article, one might say, but I really don't see him as a murderer. I'd say that wasn't in his line at all.
He paused a minute, and then said suddenly,
Do you know, if one stands back and takes a good look at all this fantastic business, Major Palgrave and his ridiculous stories and all the rest of it, the emphasis is entirely wrong. I'm the person who ought to be murdered.
Miss Marple looked at him in some surprise.
Proper typecasting, explained Mr. Raphael. Who's the victim in murder stories? Elderly men with lots of money.
And lots of people with a good reason for wishing him out of the way so as to get that money, said Miss Marple.
Is that true also?
Well, Mr. Raphael considered,
I can count up to 5 or 6 men in London who wouldn't burst into tears if they read my obituary in the Times, but they wouldn't go so far as to do anything to bring about my demise. After all, why should they? I'm expected to die any day. In fact, the blighters are astonished that I've lasted so long. The doctors are surprised, too.
You have, of course, a great will to live, said Miss Marple.
You think that's odd, I suppose, said Mr. Raphael.
Miss Marple shook her head.
Oh, no, she said. I think it's quite natural. Life is more worth living, more full of interest, when you are likely to lose it. It shouldn't be, perhaps, but it is. When you're young and strong and healthy and life stretches ahead of you, living isn't really important at all. It's young people who commit suicide easily, out of despair from love, sometimes from sheer anxiety and worry. But old people know how valuable life is and how interesting.
Ha! Said Mr. Raphael, snorting. Listen to a couple of old crocks.
Well, what I said is true, isn't it? Demanded Miss Marple.
Oh, yes, said Mr. Raphael. It's true enough. But don't you think I'm right when I say that I ought to be cast as the victim?
It depends on who has reason to gain by your death, said Miss Marple.
Nobody, really, said Mr. Raphael. Apart, as I've said, from my competitors in the business world, who, as I've also said, can count comfortably on my being out of it before very long. I'm not such a fool as to leave a lot of money to be divided up among my relations. Precious little they'd get of it after the government had taken practically the lot. Oh, no, I've attended to all that years ago. Settlements, trusts, and all the rest of it.
Jackson, for instance, wouldn't profit by your death?
He wouldn't get a penny, said Mr. Raphael cheerfully. I pay him double the salary that he'd get from anyone else. That's because he has to put up with my bad temper, and he knows quite well that he will be the loser when I die.
And Mrs. Walters?
The same goes for Esther. She's a good girl. First-class secretary, intelligent, good-tempered, understands my ways, doesn't turn a hair if I fly off the handle, couldn't care less if I insult her. Behaves like a nice nursery governess in charge of an outrageous and obstreperous child. She irritates me a bit sometimes, but who doesn't? There's nothing outstanding about her. She's rather a commonplace young woman in many ways, but I couldn't have anyone who suited me better. She's had a lot of trouble in her life. Married a man who wasn't much good. I'd say she never had much judgment when it came to men. Some women haven't. They fall for anyone who tells them a hard luck story. Always convinced that all the man needs is proper female understanding, that once married to her, he'll pull up his socks and make a go of life. But of course, that type of man never does. Anyway, fortunately, her unsatisfactory husband died. Drank too much at a party one night and stepped in front of a bus. Esther had a daughter to support, and she went back to her secretarial job. She's been with me 5 years. I made it quite clear to her from the start that she need have no expectations from me in the event of my death. I paid her from the start a very large salary, and that salary I've augmented by as much as a quarter as much again each year. However decent and honest people are, one should never trust anybody. That's why I told Esther clearly that she'd nothing to hope for from my death. Every year I live, she'll get a bigger salary. If she puts most of that aside every year, and that's what I think she has done, she'll be quite a well-to-do woman by the time I kick the bucket. I've made myself responsible for her daughter's schooling, and I've put a sum in trust for the daughter, which she'll get when she comes of age. So, Mrs. Esther Walters is very comfortably placed. My death, let me tell you, would mean a serious financial loss to her. He looked very hard at Miss Marple. She fully realises all that. She's very sensible, Esther is.
Do she and Jackson get on? Asked Miss Marple.
Mr. Raphael shot a quick glance at her. Noticed something, have you? He said. Yes, I think Jackson's done a bit of tomcatting around, with an eye in her direction, especially lately. He's a good-looking chap, of course, but he hasn't cut any ice in that direction. For one thing, there's class distinction. She's just a cut above him. Not very much. If she was really a cut above him, it wouldn't matter. But the lower middle class, they're very particular. Her mother was a school teacher and her father a bank clerk. No, she won't make a fool of herself about Jackson. Dare say he's after a little nest egg, but he won't get it.
Hush, she's coming now, said Miss Marple. They both looked at Esther Walters as she came along the hotel path towards them.
She's quite a good-looking girl, you know, said Mr. Raphael, but not an atom of glamour. I don't know why. She's quite nicely turned out.
Miss Marple sighed, a sigh that any woman will give, however old, at what might be considered wasted opportunities. What was lacking in Esther had been called by so many names during Miss Marple's span of existence. Not really attractive to men. No S.A. Lacks come hither in her eye. Fair hair, good complexion, hazel eyes, quite a good figure, pleasant smile, but lacking that something that makes a man's head turn when he passes a woman in the street. She ought to get married again, said Miss Marple, lowering her voice.
Of course she ought. She'd make a man a good wife.
Esther Walters joined them, and Mr. Raphael said in a slightly artificial voice,
"So, there you are at last. What's been keeping you?"
"Everyone seems to be sending cables this morning,"
said Esther. "What with that and people trying to check out?"
"Trying to check out, are they? A result of this murder business?"
"I suppose so. Poor Tim Kendall is worried to death."
"And well he might be. Bad luck for that young couple, I must say."
"I know. I gather it was rather a big undertaking for them to take on this place. They'd been worried about making a success of it. They were doing very well, too."
"They were doing a good job," agreed Mr. Raphael. "He's very capable and a damned hard worker. She's a very nice girl, attractive, too. They've both worked like blacks, though that's an odd term to use out here. Was looking at a fellow climbing up a coconut tree to get his breakfast, then he goes to sleep for the rest of the day. Nice life," he added. "We've been discussing the murder here."
Esther Walters looked slightly startled. She turned her head towards Miss Marple.
"I've been wrong about her," said Mr. Raphael with characteristic frankness. "Never been much of a one for the old pussies, all knitting wool and tittle-tattle. But this one's got something. Eyes and ears, and she uses them."
Esther Walters looked apologetically at Miss Marple, but Miss Marple did not appear to take offence. "That's really meant to be a compliment, you know," Esther explained.
"I quite realise that," said Miss Marple. "I realise, too, that Mr. Raphael is privileged, or thinks he is."
"What do you mean, privileged?" asked Mr. Raphael.
"To be rude, if you want to be rude," said Miss Marple.
"Have I been rude?" said Mr. Raphael, surprised. "I'm sorry if I've offended you."
"You haven't offended me," said Miss Marple. "I make allowances."
"Now don't be nasty. Esther, get a chair and bring it here. Maybe you can help."
Esther walked a few steps to the balcony of the bungalow and brought over a light basket chair.
"We'll go on with our consultation," said Mr. Raphael. "We started with old Palgrave, deceased, and his eternal stories."
"Oh, dear," said Esther. "I'm afraid I used to escape from him whenever I could."
"Miss Marple was more patient," said Mr. Raphael. "Tell me, Esther, did he ever tell you a story about a murderer?"
"Oh, yes," said Esther. "Several times."
"What was it exactly? Let's have your recollections."
"Well..." Esther paused to think. "The trouble is," she said apologetically, "I didn't really listen very closely. You see, it was rather like that terrible story about the lion in Rhodesia, which used to go on and on. One did get rather in the habit of not listening."
"Well, tell us what you do remember."
"I think it arose out of some murder case that had been in the papers. Major Palgrave said that he'd had an experience not every person had had. He'd actually met a murderer face to face."
"Met?" Mr. Raphael exclaimed. "Did he actually use the word met?"
Esther looked confused.
"I think so," she was doubtful.
"Or he may have said, 'I can point you out a murderer.'"
"Well, which was it? There's a difference."
"I can't really be sure. I think he said he'd show me a picture of someone."
"That's better."
"And then he talked a lot about Lucretia Borgia."
"Never mind Lucretia Borgia, we know all about her."
"He talked about poisoners, and that Lucretia was very beautiful and had red hair. He said there were probably far more women poisoners going about the world than anyone knew."
"That, I fear, is quite likely," said Miss Marple.
"And he talked about poison being a woman's weapon."
"Seems to have been wandering from the point a bit," said Mr. Raphael.
"Well, of course, he always did wander from the point in his stories. And then one used to stop listening and just say, 'Yes,' and 'Really,' and 'You don't say so.'"
"What about this picture he was going to show you?"
"I don't remember. It may have been something he'd seen in the paper."
"He didn't actually show you a snapshot?"
"A snapshot? No." She shook her head. "I'm quite sure of that. He did say that she was a good-looking woman, and you'd never think she was a murderer to look at her."
"She?"
"There you are," exclaimed Miss Marple. "It makes it all so confusing."
"He was talking about a woman?"
Mr. Raphael asked.
"Oh, yes."
"The snapshot was a snapshot of a woman?"
"Yes."
It can't have been.
But it was, Esther persisted. He said, she's here in this island. I'll point her out to you, and then I'll tell you the whole story.
Mr. Raphael swore. In saying what he thought of the late Major Palgrave, he did not mince his words.
The probabilities are, he finished, that not a word of anything he said was true.
One does begin to wonder, Miss Marple murmured.
So there we are, said Mr. Raphael. The old booby started telling you hunting tales. Pig-sticking, tiger-shooting, elephant-hunting, narrow escapes from lions. One or two of them might have happened to somebody else. Then he gets on to the subject of murder, and he tells one murder story to cap another murder story. And what's more, he tells them all as if they'd happened to him. 10 to 1, most of them were a hash-up of what he'd read in the paper or seen on TV.
He turned accusingly on Esther.
You admit that you weren't listening closely. Perhaps you misunderstood what he was saying.
I'm certain he was talking about a woman, Esther said obstinately, because, of course, I wondered who it was.
Who do you think it was? Asked Miss Marple. Esther flushed and looked slightly embarrassed.
Oh, I didn't really... I mean, I wouldn't like to...
Miss Marple did not insist. The presence of Mr. Raphael, she thought, was inimical to her finding out exactly what suppositions Esther Walters had made. That could only be cosily brought out in a tête-à-tête between the two women. And there was, of course, the possibility that Esther Walters was lying. Naturally, Miss Marple did not suggest this aloud. She registered it as a possibility, but she was not inclined to believe in it. For one thing, she did not think that Esther Walters was a liar, though one never knew, and for another, she could see no point in such a lie.
But you say, Mr. Raphael was now turning upon Miss Marple, you say that he told you this yarn about a murderer, and that he then said he had a picture of him which he was going to show you.
I thought so, yes.
You thought so? You were sure enough to begin with.
Miss Marple retorted with spirit. It is never easy to repeat a conversation and be entirely accurate in what the other party to it has said. One is always inclined to jump at what you think they meant. Then afterwards you put actual words into their mouths. Major Palgrave told me this story, yes. He told me that the man who told it to him, this doctor, had shown him a snapshot of the murderer. But if I am to be quite honest, I must admit that what he actually said to me was, "Would you like to see a snapshot of a murderer?" And naturally I assumed that it was the same snapshot he had been talking about, that it was the snapshot of that particular murderer. But I have to admit that it is possible, only remotely possible, but still possible, that by an association of ideas in his mind, he leapt from the snapshot he had been shown in the past to a snapshot he had taken recently of someone here whom he was convinced was a murderer.
Women, snorted Mr. Raphael in exasperation. You're all the same, the whole blinking lot of you. Can't be accurate. You're never exactly sure of what a thing was. And now, he added irritably, where does that leave us? He snorted. Evelyn Hillingdon or Greg's wife, Lucky? The whole thing is a mess.
There was a slight apologetic cough. Arthur Jackson was standing at Mr. Raphael's elbow. He had come so noiselessly that nobody had noticed him.
Time for your massage, sir, he said.
Mr. Raphael displayed immediate temper.
What do you mean by sneaking up on me in that way and making me jump? I never heard you.
Very sorry, sir.
I don't think I'll have any massage today. It never does me a damn bit of good.
Oh, come, sir, you mustn't say that.
Jackson was full of professional cheerfulness.
You'd soon notice it if you left it off.
He wheeled the chair deftly round. Miss Marple rose to her feet, smiled at Esther, and went down to the beach. Chapter 18. Without benefit of clergy. The beach was rather empty this morning. Greg was splashing in the water in his usual noisy style. Lucky was lying on her face on the beach, with a sun-tanned back well oiled and her blonde hair splayed over her shoulders. The Hillingdons were not there. Senora de Caspiaro, with an assorted bag of gentlemen in attendance, was lying face upwards and talking deep-throated, happy Spanish. Some French and Italian children were playing at the water's edge and laughing. Cannon and Miss Prescott were sitting in beach chairs observing the scene. The Canon had his hat tilted forward over his eyes and seemed half asleep. There was a convenient chair next to Miss Prescott, and Miss Marple made for it and sat down. "Oh, dear," she said with a deep sigh. "I know," said Miss Prescott. It was their joint tribute to violent death. "That poor girl," said Miss Marple.
"Very sad," said the Canon. "Most deplorable."
"For a moment or two," said Miss Prescott, "we really thought of leaving, Jeremy and I, but then we decided against it. It would not really be fair, I felt, on the Kendalls. After all, it's not their fault. It might have happened anywhere."
"In the midst of life, we are in death," said the Canon solemnly.
"It's very important, you know," said Miss Prescott, "that they should make a go of this place. They have sunk all their capital in it."
"A very sweet girl," said Miss Marple, "but not looking at all well lately."
"Very nervy," agreed Miss Prescott. "Of course, her family."
She shook her head.
"I really think, Joan," said the Canon in mild reproof, "that there are some things..."
"Everybody knows about it," said Miss Prescott. "Her family live in our part of the world. A great aunt, most peculiar, and one of her uncles took off all his clothes in one of the tube stations. Green Park, I believe it was."
"Joan, that is a thing that should not be repeated."
"Very sad," said Miss Marple, shaking her head, "though I believe not an uncommon form of madness. I know when we were working for the Armenian Relief, a most respectable elderly clergyman was afflicted the same way. They telephoned his wife, and she came along at once and took him home in a cab, wrapped in a blanket." "Of course, Molly's immediate family's all right," said Miss Prescott. "She never got on very well with her mother, but then so few girls seem to get on with their mothers nowadays."
"Such a pity," said Miss Marple, shaking her head, "because, really, a young girl needs her mother's knowledge of the world and experience."
"Exactly," said Miss Prescott, with emphasis. "Molly, you know, took up with some man. Quite unsuitable, I understand."
"It so often happens," said Miss Marple.
"Her family disapproved, naturally. She didn't tell them about it. They heard about it from a complete outsider. Of course, her mother said she must bring him along so that they met him properly. This, I understand, the girl refused to do. She said it was humiliating to him. Most insulting to be made to come and meet her family and be looked over, just as though you were a horse," she said.
Miss Marple sighed.
"One does need so much tact when dealing with the young," she murmured. "Anyway, there it was. They forbade her to see him."
"But you can't do that nowadays," said Miss Marple. "Girls have jobs, and they meet people whether anyone forbids them or not."
"But then, very fortunately," went on Miss Prescott, "she met Tim Kendall, and the other man sort of faded out of the picture. I can't tell you how relieved the family was."
"I hope they didn't show it too plainly," said Miss Marple.
"That so often puts girls off from forming suitable attachments." "Yes, indeed."
"One remembers oneself," murmured Miss Marple, her mind going back to the past. A young man she had met at a croquet party. He had seemed so nice, rather gay, almost bohemian in his views. And then he had been unexpectedly warmly welcomed by her father. He had been suitable, eligible. He had been asked freely to the house more than once. And Miss Marple had found that, after all, he was dull. Very dull. The Canon seemed safely comatose, and Miss Marple advanced tentatively to the subject she was anxious to pursue.
"Of course, you know so much about this place," she murmured. "You have been here several years running, have you not?" Well, last year, and 2 years before that, we liked St. Honoré very much. Always such nice people here, not the flashy, ultra-rich set. So I suppose you know the Hillingdons and the Dysons well. Yes, fairly well. Miss Marple coughed and lowered her voice slightly. Major Palgrave told me such an interesting story, she said. He had a great repertoire of stories, hadn't he? Of course, he had travelled very widely. Africa, India, even China, I believe. Yes, indeed, said Miss Marple. But I didn't mean one of those stories. This was a story concerned with, well, with one of the people I have just mentioned.
Oh,
said Miss Prescott. Her voice held meaning. Yes. Now, I wonder... Miss Marple allowed her eyes to travel gently round the beach to where Lucky lay sunning her back. Very beautifully tanned, isn't she? Remarked Miss Marple. And her hair, most attractive, practically the same colour as Molly Kendall's, isn't it? The only difference, said Miss Prescott, is that Molly's is natural and Lucky's comes out of a bottle.
Really, Joan, the Canon protested, unexpectedly awake again. Don't you think that is rather an uncharitable thing to say?
It's not uncharitable, said Miss Prescott acidly, merely a fact.
It looks very nice to me, said the Canon.
Of course, that's why she does it. But I assure you, my dear Jeremy, it wouldn't deceive any woman for a moment, would it? She appealed to Miss Marple. Well, I'm afraid, said Miss Marple. Of course, I haven't the experience that you have, but I'm afraid, yes, I should say definitely not natural. The appearance at the roots every fifth or sixth day?
She looked at Miss Prescott, and they both nodded with quiet female assurance. The Canon appeared to be dropping off again.
Major Palgrave told me a really extraordinary story, murmured Miss Marple, about, well, I couldn't quite make out. I am a little deaf sometimes. He appeared to be saying or hinting. She paused. I know what you mean. There was a great deal of talk at the time. You mean at the time that, when the first Mrs. Dyson died? Her death was quite unexpected. In fact, everybody thought she was a malade imaginaire, a hypochondriac. So when she had this attack and died so unexpectedly, well, of course, people did talk. There wasn't any trouble at the time. The doctor was puzzled. He was quite a young man, and he hadn't had much experience. He was what I call one of those antibiotics for all men. You know, the kind that doesn't bother to look at the patient much or worry what's the matter with him. They just give them some kind of pill out of a bottle, and if they don't get better, then they try a different pill. Yes, I believe he was puzzled, but it seemed she had had gastric trouble before. At least her husband said so, and there seemed no reason for believing anything was wrong. But you yourself think... Well, I always try to keep an open mind, but one does wonder, you know, and what with various things people said.
Joan!
The Canon sat up. He looked belligerent.
I really don't like to hear this kind of ill-natured gossip being repeated. We've always set our faces against that kind of thing. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, and what is more, think no evil. That should be the motto of every Christian man and woman.
The two women sat in silence. They were rebuked, and in deference to their training, they deferred to the criticism of a man. But inwardly they were frustrated, irritated, and quite unrepentant. Miss Prescott threw a frank glance of irritation towards her brother. Miss Marple took out her knitting and looked at it. Fortunately for them, chance was on their side.
Mon père,
said a small, shrill voice. It was one of the French children who had been playing at the water's edge. She had come up unnoticed and was standing by Canon Prescott's chair.
Mon père,
she fluted.
Eh? Yes, my dear. Oui, qu'est-ce qu'il y a, ma petite?
the child explained. There had been a dispute about who should have the water wings next, and also other matters of seaside etiquette. Canon Prescott was extremely fond of children, especially small girls. He was always delighted to be summoned to act as arbiter in their disputes. He rose willingly now and accompanied the child to the water's edge. Miss Marple and Miss Prescott breathed deep sighs and turned avidly towards each other.
"Jeremy, of course, rightly, is very against ill-natured gossip," said Miss Prescott, "but one cannot really ignore what people are saying. And there was, as I say, a great deal of talk at the time."
"Yes?" Miss Marple's tone urged her forward.
"This young woman, you see, Miss Greatorex, I think her name was then, I can't remember now, was a kind of cousin, and she looked after Mrs. Dyson, gave her all her medicines and things like that."
There was a short, meaningful pause.
"And, of course, there had, I understand," Miss Prescott's voice was lowered, "been goings-on between Mr. Dyson and Miss Greatorex. A lot of people had noticed them. I mean, things like that are quickly observed in a place like this. Then there was some curious story about some stuff that Edward Hillingdon got for her at a chemist."
"Oh, Edward Hillingdon came into it.
Oh, yes, he was very much attracted. People noticed it. And lucky, Miss Greatorex played them off against each other, Gregory Dyson and Edward Hillingdon. One has to face it, she has always been an attractive woman."
"Though not as young as she was," Miss Marple replied.
"Exactly. But she was always very well turned out and made up. Of course, not so flamboyant when she was just the poor relation. She always seemed very devoted to the invalid. But, well, you see how it was."
"What was this story about the chemist? How did that get known?"
"Well, it wasn't in Jamestown. I think it was when they were in Martinique. The French, I believe, are more lax than we are in the matter of drugs. This chemist talked to someone, and the story got around. Well, you know how these things happen."
Miss Marple did. None better.
"He said something about Colonel Hillingdon asking for something and not seeming to know what it was he was asking for. Consulting a piece of paper, you know, on which it was written down. Anyway, as I say, there was talk.
But I don't see quite why Colonel Hillingdon..." Miss Marple frowned in perplexity.
"I suppose he was just being used as a cat's paw. Anyway, Gregory Dyson married again in an almost indecently short time. Barely a month later, I understand."
They looked at each other.
"But there was no real suspicion?" Miss Marple asked. "Oh, no. It was just, well, talk. Of course, there may have been absolutely nothing in it."
"Major Palgrave thought there was."
"Did he say so to you?"
"I wasn't really listening very closely," confessed Miss Marple.
"I just wondered if, well, if he'd said the same things to you." "He did point her out to me one day," said Miss Prescott.
"Really? He actually pointed her out?"
"Yes. As a matter of fact, I thought at first it was Mrs. Hillingdon he was pointing out. He wheezed and chuckled a bit and said, 'Look at that woman over there. In my opinion, that's a woman who's done murder and got away with it.' I was very shocked, of course. I said, 'Surely you're joking, Major Palgrave.' And he said, 'Yes, yes, dear lady, let's call it joking.' The Dysons and the Hillingdons were sitting at a table quite near to us, and I was afraid they'd overhear. He chuckled and said, 'Wouldn't care to go to a drink party and have a certain person mix me a cocktail. Too much like supper with the Borgias.'"
"How very interesting," said Miss Marple.
"Did he mention a photograph?" "I don't remember. Was it some newspaper cutting?"
Miss Marple, about to speak, shut her lips. The sun was momentarily obscured by a shadow. Evelyn Hillingdon paused beside them.
"Good morning," she said.
"I was wondering where you were," said Miss Prescott, looking up brightly.
"I've been to Jamestown shopping."
"Oh, I see."
Miss Prescott looked round vaguely, and Evelyn Hillingdon said, "Oh, I didn't take Edward with me. Men hate shopping."
"Did you find anything of interest?"
"It wasn't that sort of shopping. I just had to go to the chemist."
With a smile and a slight nod, she went on down the beach.
"Such nice people, the Hillingdons," said Miss Prescott. "Though she's not really very easy to know, is she? I mean, she's always very pleasant and all that, but one never seems to get to know her any better."
Miss Marple agreed thoughtfully.
"One never knows what she is thinking," said Miss Prescott.
"Perhaps that is just as well," said Miss Marple.
"I beg your pardon?" "Oh, nothing really. Only that I've always had the feeling that perhaps her thoughts might be rather disconcerting."
"Oh," said Miss Prescott, looking puzzled.
"I see what you mean."
She went on with a slight change of subject.
"I believe they have a very charming place in Hampshire, and a boy, or is it two boys, who've just gone, or one of them, to Winchester."
"Do you know Hampshire well?"
"No, hardly at all. I believe their house is somewhere near Alton."
"I see." Miss Marple paused, and then said, "And where do the Dysons live?"
"California," said Miss Prescott. "When they are at home, that is. They are great travellers."
"One really knows so little about the people one meets when one is travelling," said Miss Marple.
"I mean, how shall I put it? One only knows, doesn't one, what they choose to tell you about themselves. For instance, you don't really know that the Dysons live in California."
Miss Prescott looked startled.
"I'm sure Mr. Dyson mentioned it."
"Yes, yes, exactly. That's what I mean. And the same thing perhaps with the Hillingdons. I mean, when you say that they live in Hampshire, you're really repeating what they told you, aren't you?"
Miss Prescott looked slightly alarmed.
"Do you mean that they don't live in Hampshire?" she asked.
"No, no, not for one moment," said Miss Marple, quickly apologetic. "I was only using them as an instance as to what one knows or doesn't know about people." She added, "I have told you that I live in St. Mary Mead, which is a place, no doubt, of which you have never heard. But you don't, if I may say so, know it of your own knowledge, do you?"
Miss Prescott forbore from saying that she really couldn't care less where Miss Marple lived. It was somewhere in the country and in the south of England, and that was all she knew.
"Oh, I do see what you mean," she agreed hastily, "and I know that one can't possibly be too careful when one is abroad."
"I didn't exactly mean that," said Miss Marple.
There were some odd thoughts going through Miss Marple's mind. Did she really know, she was asking herself, that Canon Prescott and Miss Prescott were really Canon Prescott and Miss Prescott? They said so. There was no evidence to contradict them. It would really be easy, would it not, to put on a dog collar, to wear the appropriate clothes, to make the appropriate conversation, if there was a motive? Miss Marple was fairly knowledgeable about the clergy in her part of the world, but the Prescotts came from the north. Durham, wasn't it? She had no doubt they were the Prescotts. But still, it came back to the same thing. One believed what people said to one. Perhaps one ought to be on one's guard against that. Perhaps... She shook her head thoughtfully.
Chapter 19. Uses of a Shoe.
Canon Prescott came back from the water's edge, slightly short of breath. Playing with children is always exhausting. Presently he and his sister went back to the hotel, finding the beach a little too hot.
"But," said Signora de Caspiaro scornfully, as they walked away, "how can a beach be too hot? It is nonsense, that. And look what she wears. Her arms and her neck are all covered up. Perhaps it is as well that her skin, it is hideous, like a plucked chicken."
Miss Marple drew a deep breath. Now or never was the time for conversation with Signora de Caspiaro. Unfortunately, she did not know what to say. There seemed to be no common ground on which they could meet.
"You have children, Signora?" she inquired.
"I have three angels," said Signora de Caspiaro, kissing her fingertips.
Miss Marple was rather uncertain as to whether this meant that Signora de Caspiaro's offspring were in heaven, or whether it merely referred to their characters. One of the gentlemen in attendance made a remark in Spanish, and Signora de Caspiaro flung back her head appreciatively and laughed loudly and melodiously.
"You understand what he said?"
she inquired of Miss Marple.
"I'm afraid not," said Miss Marple apologetically.
"It is just as well. He is a wicked man."
A rapid and spirited interchange of Spanish badinage followed.
"It is infamous, infamous,"
said Signora de Caspiaro, reverting to English with sudden gravity,
"that the police do not let us go from this island. I storm, I scream, I stamp on my foot, but all they say is no, no. You know how it will end. We shall all be killed."
Her bodyguard attempted to reassure her.
"But yes, I tell you, it is unlucky here. I knew it from the first. That old major, the ugly one, he had the evil eye, you remember? His eyes, they crossed. It is bad, that. I make the sign of the horns every time when he looks my way."
She made it in illustration.
"Though, since he is cross-eyed, I am not always sure when he does look my way."
"He had a glass eye," said Miss Marple, in an explanatory voice. "An accident, I understand, when he was quite young. It was not his fault."
"I tell you, he brought bad luck. I say it is the evil eye he had."
Her hand shot out again in the well-known Latin gesture, the first finger and the little finger sticking out, the two middle ones doubled in.
"Anyway," she said cheerfully, "he is dead. I do not have to look at him any more. I do not like to look at things that are ugly."
It was, Miss Marple thought, a somewhat cruel epitaph on Major Palgrave. Farther down the beach, Gregory Dyson had come out of the sea. Lucky had turned herself over on the sand. Evelyn Hillingdon was looking at Lucky, and her expression, for some reason, made Miss Marple shiver. "Surely I can't be cold in this hot sun," she thought. What was the old phrase? "A goose walking over your grave?" She got up and went slowly back to her bungalow. On the way, she passed Mr. Raphael and Esther Walters coming down the beach. Mr. Raphael winked at her. Miss Marple did not wink back. She looked disapproving. She went into her bungalow and lay down on her bed. She felt old and tired and worried. She was quite certain that there was no time to be lost. No time to be lost. It was getting late. The sun was going to set. The sun! One must always look at the sun through smoked glass. Where was that piece of smoked glass that someone had given her? No, she wouldn't need it after all. A shadow had come over the sun, blotting it out. A shadow. Evelyn Hillingdon's shadow. No, not Evelyn Hillingdon. The shadow, what were the words? The shadow of the Valley of Death. That was it. She must, what was it? Make the sign of the horns to avert the evil eye. Major Palgrave's evil eye. Her eyelids flickered open. She had been asleep. But there was a shadow. Someone peering in at her window. The shadow moved away, and Miss Marple saw who it was. It was Jackson. Impertinence, peering in like that, she thought, and added, parenthetically, just like Jonas Parry. The comparison reflected no credit on Jackson. Then she wondered why Jackson had been peering into her bedroom. To see if she was there, or to note that she was there but was asleep. She got up, went into the bathroom, and peered cautiously through the window. Arthur Jackson was standing by the door of the bungalow next door, Mr. Raphael's bungalow. She saw him give a rapid glance round and then slip quickly inside. Interesting, thought Miss Marple. Why did he have to look round in that furtive manner? Nothing in the world could have been more natural than his going into Mr. Raphael's bungalow, since he himself had a room at the back of it. He was always going in and out of it on some errand or other. So why that quick, guilty glance round? Only one reason, said Miss Marple, answering her own question. He wanted to be sure that nobody was observing him enter at this particular moment because of something he was going to do in there. Everybody, of course, was on the beach at this moment, except those who had gone for expeditions. In about 20 minutes or so, Jackson himself would arrive on the beach, in the course of his duties, to aid Mr. Raphael to take his sea dip. If he wanted to do anything in the bungalow unobserved, now was a very good time. He had satisfied himself that Miss Marple was asleep on her bed. He had satisfied himself that there was nobody near at hand to observe his movements. Well, she must do her best to do exactly that. Sitting down on her bed, Miss Marple removed her neat sandal shoes and replaced them with a pair of sneakers. Then she shook her head, removed the sneakers, burrowed in her suitcase, and took out a pair of shoes, the heel on one of which she had recently caught on a hook by the door. It was now in a slightly precarious state, and Miss Marple adroitly rendered it even more precarious by attention with a nail file. Then she emerged, with due precaution, from her door, walking in stockinged feet. With all the care of a big game hunter approaching upwind of a herd of antelope, Miss Marple gently circumnavigated Mr. Raphael's bungalow. Cautiously, she manoeuvred her way around the corner of the house. She put on one of the shoes she was carrying, gave a final wrench to the heel of the other, sank gently to her knees, and lay prone under the window. If Jackson heard anything, if he came to the window to look out, an old lady would have had a fall owing to the heel coming off her shoe. But evidently Jackson had heard nothing. Very, very gently, Miss Marple raised her head. The windows of the bungalow were low. Shielding herself slightly with a festoon of creeper, she peered inside. Jackson was on his knees before a suitcase. The lid of the suitcase was up, and Miss Marple could see that it was a specially fitted affair containing compartments filled with various kinds of papers. Jackson was looking through the papers, occasionally drawing documents out of long envelopes. Miss Marple did not remain at her observation post for long. All she wanted was to know what Jackson was doing. She knew now. Jackson was snooping. Whether he was looking for something in particular, or whether he was just indulging his natural instincts, she had no means of judging. But it confirmed her in her belief that Arthur Jackson and Jonas Parry had strong affinities in other things than facial resemblance. Her problem was now to withdraw. Very carefully, she dropped down again and crept along the flowerbed until she was clear of the window. She returned to her bungalow and carefully put away the shoe and the heel that she had detached from it. She looked at them with affection. A good device which she could use on another day if necessary. She resumed her own sandal shoes and went thoughtfully down to the beach again. Choosing a moment when Esther Walters was in the water, Miss Marple moved into the chair Esther had vacated. Greg and Lucky were laughing and talking with Signora de Caspiaro and making a good deal of noise. Miss Marple spoke very quietly, almost under her breath, without looking at Mr. Raphael. "Do you know that Jackson snoops?"
"Doesn't surprise me," said Mr. Raphael. "Caught him at it, did you?"
"I managed to observe him through a window.
he had one of your suitcases open and was looking through your papers.
Must have managed to get hold of a key to it. Resourceful fellow. He'll be disappointed, though. Nothing he gets hold of in that way will do him a mite of good.
He's coming down now, said Miss Marple, glancing up towards the hotel.
Time for that idiotic sea dip of mine.
He spoke again, very quietly.
As for you, don't be too enterprising. We don't want to be attending your funeral next. Remember your age and be careful. There's somebody about who isn't too scrupulous, remember.
Chapter 20 Night Alarm. Evening came. The lights came up on the terrace. People dined and talked and laughed, albeit less loudly and merrily than they had a day or two ago. The steel band played. But the dancing ended early. People yawned, went off to bed. The lights went out. There was darkness and stillness. The golden palm tree slept.
Evelyn! Evelyn!
The whisper came sharp and urgent. Evelyn Hillington stirred and turned on her pillow.
Evelyn, please wake up.
Evelyn Hillington sat up abruptly. Tim Kendall was standing in the doorway. She stared at him in surprise.
Evelyn, please, could you come? It's Molly. She's ill. I don't know what's the matter with her. I think she must have taken something.
Evelyn was quick, decisive.
All right, Tim, I'll come. You go back to her. I'll be with you in a moment.
Tim Kendall disappeared. Evelyn slipped out of bed, threw on a dressing gown, and looked across at the other bed. Her husband, it seemed, had not been awakened. He lay there, his head turned away, breathing quietly. Evelyn hesitated for a moment, then decided not to disturb him. She went out of the door and walked rapidly to the main building and beyond it to the Kendalls' bungalow. She caught up with Tim in the doorway. Molly lay in bed. Her eyes were closed and her breathing was clearly not natural. Evelyn bent over her, rolled up an eyelid, felt her pulse, and then looked at the bedside table. There was a glass there which had been used. Beside it was an empty phial of tablets. She picked it up.
They were her sleeping pills, said Tim. But that bottle was half full yesterday or the day before. I think she must have taken the lot.
Go and get Dr. Graham, said Evelyn,
and on the way, waken one of the cooks and tell him to make strong coffee. Strong as possible. Hurry!
Tim dashed off. Just outside the doorway, he collided with Edward Hillingdon.
Oh, sorry, Edward.
What's happening here? Demanded Hillingdon. What's going on?
It's Molly. Evelyn's with her. I must get hold of the doctor. I suppose I ought to have gone to him first, but I wasn't sure, and I thought Evelyn would know. Molly would have hated it if I'd fetched a doctor when it wasn't necessary.
He went off, running. Edward Hillingdon looked after him for a moment, and then he walked into the bedroom.
What's happening? He said. Is it serious?
Oh, there you are, Edward. I wondered if you'd woken up. This silly child has been taking things.
Is it bad?
One can't tell without knowing how much he's taken. I shouldn't think it was too bad if we get going in time. I've sent for coffee. If we can get some of that down her.
But why should she do such a thing?
You don't think...
He stopped.
What don't I think? Asked Evelyn.
You don't think it's because of the inquiry, the police, all that?
It's possible, of course. That sort of thing could be very alarming to a nervous type.
Molly never used to seem a nervous type.
One can't really tell, said Evelyn. It's the most unlikely people sometimes who lose their nerve.
Yes, I remember.
Again he stopped.
The truth is, said Evelyn, that one doesn't really know anything about anybody. She added, not even the people who are nearest to you.
Isn't that going a little too far, Evelyn? Exaggerating too much?
I don't think it is. When you think of people, it is in the image you have made of them for yourself.
I know you, said Edward Hillingdon quietly.
You think you do?
No, I'm sure, he added. And you're sure of me.
Evelyn looked at him.
then turned back to the bed. She took Molly by the shoulders and shook her.
"We ought to be doing something, but I suppose it's better to wait until Dr. Graham comes. Oh, I think I hear them."
"She'll do now."
Dr. Graham stepped back, wiped his forehead with a handkerchief, and breathed a sigh of relief.
"You think she'll be all right, sir?"
Tim demanded anxiously.
"Yes, yes, we got to her in good time. Anyway, she probably didn't take enough to kill her. A couple of days and she'll be as right as rain. But she'll have a rather nasty day or two first."
He picked up the empty bottle.
"Who gave her these things, anyway?"
"A doctor in New York. She wasn't sleeping well."
"Well, well. I know all we medicos hand these things out freely nowadays. Nobody tells young women who can't sleep to count sheep, or get up and eat a biscuit, or write a couple of letters and then go back to bed. Instant remedies, that's what people demand nowadays. Sometimes I think it's a pity we give them to them. You've got to learn to put up with things in life. All very well to stuff a comforter into a baby's mouth to stop it crying. Can't go on doing that all a person's life."
He gave a small chuckle.
"I bet you, if you ask Miss Marple what she does if she can't sleep, she'd tell you she counted sheep going under a gate."
He turned back to the bed where Molly was stirring. Her eyes were open now. She looked at them without interest or recognition. Dr. Graham took her hand.
"Well, well, my dear, and what have you been doing to yourself?"
She blinked, but did not reply.
"Why did you do it, Molly? Why? Tell me why."
Tim took her other hand. Still, her eyes did not move. If they rested on anyone, it was on Evelyn Hillingdon. There might have been even a faint question in them, but it was hard to tell. Evelyn spoke as though there had been the question.
"Tim came and fetched me," she said.
Her eyes went to Tim, then shifted to Dr. Graham.
"You're going to be all right now," said Dr. Graham, "but don't do it again."
"She didn't mean to do it," said Tim quietly. "I'm sure she didn't mean to do it. She just wanted a good night's rest. Perhaps the pills didn't work at first, and so she took more of them. Is that it, Molly?"
Her head moved very faintly in a negative motion.
"You mean you took them on purpose?" said Tim.
Molly spoke then.
"Yes," she said. "But why, Molly? Why?"
The eyelids faltered.
"Afraid."
The word was just heard.
"Afraid? Of what?"
But her eyelids closed down.
"Better let her be," said Dr. Graham.
Tim spoke impetuously.
"Afraid of what? The police? Because they've been hounding you, asking you questions? I don't wonder. Anyone might feel frightened. But it's just their way, that's all. Nobody thinks for one moment..."
He broke off. Dr. Graham made him a decisive gesture.
"I want to go to sleep," said Molly.
"The best thing for you," said Dr. Graham.
He moved to the door, and the others followed him.
"She'll sleep all right," said Graham.
"Is there anything I ought to do?"
asked Tim. He had the usual slightly apprehensive attitude of a man in illness.
"I'll stay if you like," said Evelyn kindly. No, no, that's quite all right," said Tim.
Evelyn went back towards the bed. "Shall I stay with you, Molly?" Molly's eyes opened again. She said,
"No."
And then, after a pause,
"Just Tim."
Tim came back and sat down by the bed.
"I'm here, Molly," he said, and took her hand. "Just go to sleep. I won't leave you."
She sighed faintly, and her eyes closed. The doctor paused outside the bungalow, and the Hillingdons stood with him.
"You're sure there's nothing more I can do?" asked Evelyn.
"I don't think so, thank you, Mrs. Hillingdon. She'll be better with her husband now, but possibly tomorrow. After all, he's got this hotel to run. I think someone should be with her." "Do you think she might try again?" asked Hillingdon.
Graham rubbed his forehead irritably.
"One never knows in these cases. Actually, it's most unlikely. As you've seen for yourselves, the restorative treatment is extremely unpleasant. But of course, one can never be absolutely certain. She may have more of this stuff hidden away somewhere. I should never have thought of suicide in connection with a girl like Molly, said Hillingdon.
Graham said dryly, It's not the people who are always talking of killing themselves, threatening to do so, who do it. They dramatize themselves that way and let off steam.
Molly always seemed such a happy girl. I think perhaps, Evelyn hesitated, I ought to tell you, Dr. Graham.
She told him then about her interview with Molly on the beach the night that Victoria had been killed. Graham's face was very grave when she had finished.
I'm glad you've told me, Mrs. Hillingdon. There are very definite indications there of some kind of deep-rooted trouble. Yes, I'll have a word with her husband in the morning. I want to talk to you seriously, Kendall, about your wife.
They were sitting in Tim's office. Evelyn Hillingdon had taken his place by Molly's bedside, and Lucky had promised to come and, as she expressed it, spell her later. Miss Marple had also offered her services. Poor Tim was torn between his hotel commitments and his wife's condition.
I can't understand it, said Tim. I can't understand Molly any longer. She's changed out of all seeming.
I understand she's been having bad dreams.
Yes, she complained about them a good deal.
For how long?
Oh, I don't know. About a month, perhaps longer. We thought they were just, nightmares, you know?
Yes, I quite understand. But what's a much more serious sign is the fact that she seems to have felt afraid of someone.
Did she complain about that to you?
Well, yes, she said once or twice that, people were following her.
Ah, spying on her? Yes, she did use that term once. She said they were her enemies and they'd followed her here.
Did she have enemies, Mr. Kendall?
No, of course she didn't.
No incident in England? Anything you know about before you were married?
Oh, no, nothing of that kind. She didn't get on with her family very well, that was all. Her mother was rather an eccentric woman, difficult to live with, perhaps, but...
Any signs of mental instability in her family? Tim opened his mouth impulsively, then shut it again. He pushed a fountain pen about on the desk in front of him. The doctor said,
I must stress the fact that it would be better to tell me, Tim, if that is the case.
Well, yes, I believe so. Nothing serious, but I believe there was an aunt or something who was a bit batty. But that's nothing. I mean, well, you get that in almost any family.
Oh, yes, that's quite true. I'm not trying to alarm you about that, but it just might show a tendency to, to break down or imagine things if any stress arose.
I don't really know very much, said Tim. After all, people don't pour out all their family histories to you, do they?
No, quite so. She had no former friend. She was not engaged to anyone. Anyone who might have threatened her or made jealous threats, that sort of thing.
I don't know. I don't think so. Molly was engaged to some other man before I came along. Her parents were against it, I understand, and I think she really stuck to the chap more out of opposition and defiance than anything else.
He gave a sudden half-grin.
You know what it is when you're young. If people cut up a fuss, it makes you much keener on whoever it is.
Dr. Graham smiled too.
Ah, yes, one often sees that. One should never take exception to one's children's objectionable friends. Usually they grow out of them naturally. This man, whoever he was, didn't make any threats of any kind against Molly.
No, I'm sure he didn't. She would have told me. She said herself she just had a silly adolescent craze on him, mainly because he had such a bad reputation.
Yes. Well, that doesn't sound serious. Now, there's another thing. Apparently, your wife has had what she describes as blackouts, brief passages of time during which she can't account for her actions. Did you know about that, Tim?
No, said Tim slowly. No, I didn't. She never told me.
I did notice, you know, now you mention it, that she seemed rather vague sometimes, and...
He paused, thinking.
Yes, that explains it. I couldn't understand how she seemed to have forgotten the simplest things, or sometimes seemed not to know what time of day it was. I just thought she was absent-minded, I suppose.
What it amounts to, Tim, is just this. I advise you most strongly to take your wife to see a good specialist. Tim flushed angrily.
You mean a mental specialist, I suppose?
Now, don't be upset by labels. A neurologist, a psychologist, someone who specializes in what the layman calls nervous breakdowns. There's a good man in Kingston, or there's New York, of course. There is something that is causing these nervous terrors of your wife's. Something, perhaps, for which she hardly knows the reason herself. Get advice about her, Tim. Get advice as soon as possible.
He clapped his hand on the young man's shoulder and got up.
There's no immediate worry. Your wife has good friends, and we'll all be keeping an eye on her.
She won't... You don't think she'll try it again?
I think it most unlikely, said Dr. Graham.
You can't be sure, said Tim.
One can never be sure, said Dr. Graham.
That's one of the first things you learn in my profession.
Again, he laid a hand on Tim's shoulder.
Don't worry too much.
That's easy to say, said Tim, as the doctor went out of the door. Don't worry, indeed. What does he think I'm made of?
Chapter 21 Jackson on Cosmetics.
You're sure you don't mind, Miss Marple? Said Evelyn Hillingdon.
No, indeed, my dear, said Miss Marple. I'm only too delighted to be of use in any way. At my age, you know, one feels very useless in the world, especially when I'm in a place like this, just enjoying myself, no duties of any kind. No, I'll be delighted to sit with Molly. You go along on your expedition. Pelican Point, wasn't it?
Yes, said Evelyn. Both Edward and I love it. I never get tired of seeing the birds diving down, catching up the fish. Tim's with Molly now, but he's got things to do, and he doesn't seem to like her being left alone.
He's quite right, said Miss Marple. I wouldn't in his place. One never knows, does one, when anyone has attempted anything of that kind. Well, go along, my dear.
Evelyn went off to join a little group that was waiting for her, her husband, the Dysons, and three or four other people.
Miss Marple checked her knitting requirements, saw that she had all she wanted with her, and walked over towards the Kendalls' bungalow. As she came up to the loggia, she heard Tim's voice through the half-open French window.
"If only you'd tell me why you did it, Molly. What made you? Was it anything I did? There must be some reason. If you'd only tell me."
Miss Marple paused. There was a little pause inside before Molly spoke. Her voice was flat and tired.
"I don't know, Tim. I really don't know. I suppose something came over me."
Miss Marple tapped on the window and walked in.
"Oh, there you are, Miss Marple. It is very good of you."
"Not at all," said Miss Marple. "I'm delighted to be of any help. Shall I sit here in this chair? You're looking much better, Molly. I'm so glad."
"I'm all right," said Molly. "Quite all right. Just sleepy."
"I shan't talk," said Miss Marple. "You just lie quiet and rest. I'll get on with my knitting."
Tim Kendall threw her a grateful glance and went out. Miss Marple established herself in her chair. Molly was lying on her left side. She had a half-stupefied, exhausted look. She said in a voice that was almost a whisper,
"It's very kind of you, Miss Marple. I think I'll go to sleep."
She half turned away on her pillows and closed her eyes. Her breathing grew more regular, though it was still far from normal. Long experience of nursing made Miss Marple almost automatically straighten the sheet and tuck it under the mattress on her side of the bed. As she did so, her hand encountered something hard and rectangular under the mattress.
rather surprised, she took hold of this and pulled it out. It was a book. Miss Marple threw a quick glance at the girl in the bed, but she lay there, utterly quiescent. She was evidently asleep. Miss Marple opened the book. It was, she saw, a current work on nervous diseases. It came open naturally at a certain place, which gave a description of the onset of persecution mania and various other manifestations of schizophrenia and allied complaints. It was not a highly technical book, but one that could be easily understood by a layman. Miss Marple's face grew very grave as she read. After a minute or two, she closed the book and stayed thinking. Then she bent forward and, with some care, replaced the book where she had found it, under the mattress. She shook her head in some perplexity. Noiselessly, she rose from her chair. She walked the few steps towards the window, then turned her head sharply over her shoulder. Molly's eyes were open, but even as Miss Marple turned, the eyes shut again. For a minute or two, Miss Marple was not quite certain whether she might not have imagined that quick, sharp glance. Was Molly, then, only pretending to be asleep? That might be natural enough. She might feel that Miss Marple would start talking to her if she showed herself awake. Yes, that could be all it was. Was she reading into that glance of Molly's a kind of slyness that was somehow innately disagreeable? One doesn't know, Miss Marple thought to herself. One really doesn't know. She decided that she would try to manage a little talk with Dr. Graham as soon as it could be managed. She came back to her chair by the bed. She decided, after about 5 minutes or so, that Molly was really asleep. No one could have lain so still, could have breathed so evenly.